Welcome back to What's Ailing America, the ultimate in reality radio. On this show, you will not only learn what is ailing America and the world, but you will also learn how to recognize the patterns used by the predators controlling our world. The ability to overstand and see the big picture is a critical skill necessary to formulate the solutions we need to escape the living hell we find ourselves in. Regarding healthcare, this became self-evident to me in 1999 when I created the Big Picture of All Diseases, which is the first diagram that you can find on both of my websites, reversingvaccineinduceddiseases.com and drcarly.com. If you haven't yet done so, I strongly suggest you print out those diagrams and listen to the YouTube videos posted of me explaining them. Facing the reality that the psychopaths which control our world have created a hell on earth intentionally is a critical step in bringing forth an anti-hell. Overstanding the simplicity of the master template of how this hell has been created makes the antidote equally simple. We don't need all the details. All that is necessary is for people of conscience to say no to their predators, to stop loving their predators, forgiving them, making excuses for them, and to stop paying cash for being harmed. It is my goal to give you the truth of what I have learned to arm you with the confidence to ask the hard questions, which not only cause the predators to run away, but will also cause those around you to face the monsters destroying their lives. You will learn from my guests that there are many of us standing up. And my guest today is a perfect example of that. Silence is consent. Speaking the truth and asking hard questions in great numbers is what we need to do. And it's not just enough to believe that the truth will set you free. We have to act on the truth because compromise with evil is impossible. If you think my work is important, please tell others about this show. You can support my work by donating on the PayPal buttons on either of my sites, or you can help friends or family who are too ill to face reality by getting a consult for them and helping them escape from the death and disease being caused by the medical devils. You can contact me by emailing me at drcarly@gmail.com. Or calling me at 828-294-0662 between 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time any day of the week. Thanks to Ron at Dependable Voice, I also have a toll-free number, 888-321-6751, on which you can contact me from anywhere in the U.S., Canada, or the Caribbean. If you get a strange message that the number's been disconnected or whatever, have the operator dial it for you because strange things happen on a regular basis. My Skype username is drcarly1, but I use Skype primarily for international clients and radio shows. I do not practice medicine nor give medical advice. Rather, I teach you what I would do if I were you to reverse disease with natural therapies in people and in pets. Please support Orion Talk Radio Network by donating on the homepage, and you can also buy a t-shirt to help spread the word about the station. If you have questions or comments during the show, you can call in at 716-213-6816 or toll-free, thanks again to Ron, at 888-320-6151. However, we do ask that listeners not use the toll-free number to listen to the show. Very important, callers need to mute their phones while waiting to be brought on so as not to cause interference with whoever is speaking, such as my dogs are doing right now. I'm very excited. I also now have a show out of the UK on These Changing Times, radio.ning.com, every Sunday from 12 noon to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This site and calling numbers for that show are posted on my page on Sheldon Day's The Light of Day Radio Show.com. And I also want to just say, if callers could wait till the second hour to call in, I appreciate it. One of the most important things you can do to protect yourself and your loved ones from the organisms being created by the mad scientists at the over 1,300 biowarfare labs in the U.S. alone is purchase a silver lungs colloidal silver generator. Go to the link section of reversingvaccineinduceddiseases.com to learn how to obtain the generator I recommend and use personally for myself and all my pets. On today's show, the answer to what's ailing America is going to be the Holocaust hoax with one of my favorite radio talk show personalities, Deanna Spingola. She has a show on republicbroadcasting.org Monday through Friday from 11 to 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. She has a website, Spingola, S-P-I-N-G-O-L-A.com/radio. You can go there to get her radio schedule. She's much more organized than me and actually announces who our guests are going to be. She's written two books, The Ruling Elite, A Study in Imperialism, which I have in front of me, A Study in Imperialism, Genocide, and Emancipation, over 600 pages of outstanding research. And she's working on her new book, which will be out soon, The Ruling Elite, The Zionist Seizure of World Power. I just want to mention a couple things quickly. I covered for Tim Watson today. I know a lot of you like to listen to my shows on vaccines, and so if you go to RyanTalkRadio.com, you can check out the archive of that show, where I told about how we now have the zombie apocalypse happening in Uganda, which I'm sure is vaccine-induced without question. Some good news, Donald Trump has come out publicly linking vaccines to autism. Of course, he's still saying he's not against vaccines, so we have the usual situation. But for somebody like him to come out and state that he's seen it with his own two eyes, that there's a vaccine autism link, it's certainly only going to help us. So, Deanna, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. In my opinion, you have one of the best shows on internet radio, and I strongly encourage listeners to check out her show. She has so many interesting guests, and one thing I have not been able to study in great detail is the Holocaust hoax, and I know you've had so many guests on that have talked about this, so I thought there's probably nobody that knows more about it than you, because not only have you done all your own research, but you've had all these other people that have been researching this on your show, so I think you're probably one of the most knowledgeable people on this topic, so welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I was kind of laughing silently when I heard your dogs. I thought, whoops, they're there.
You know, yeah. Well, actually, let me just say, it's really not funny because whenever I do a show, and I have to get up and shut the door quickly, whenever I do a show, I live on the end of a dead-end street. Wait, hold on a second. All right, kids, all right.
Okay, so she's going to take care of the dogs. And, you know, one thing about animals, they're just unpredictable. And if they're going to bark, they're going to bark when they want to and not when it's convenient for their owners. And when I do my radio program, I have a new cat. He's a six-month-old kitten. And he gets into a lot of mischief. So when I do my radio program, I have to put him in his room. So I know where he's at. And
right. Well, see, my situation is the powers that be know when I have a show. And it's so obvious because I live at the end of a dead-end street, but it never fails. As soon as I start my show, I have what I call slave work units walking back and forth in front of my house. So, of course, that's what the dogs do. They go crazy. But that's okay. I shut the door, and we'll just have to deal with it. Okay, so just take it wherever you want to go. I want to say that it's so obvious. I sent you a YouTube video, this individual who it calls himself the Brave Young Jew, and he's got a lot of true information about the Zionists, but the first thing he starts with is talking about how his relatives, his grandparents, I think he says, were killed in the Holocaust. And there's another guy by the name of Norman Finkelstein. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
He wrote a book. I have his books. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, the Holocaust books. Industry, right. And so basically, you know, he's pro-Palestinian and blah, 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 but he also spreads this hoax about the Holocaust. So I'm just going to let you take it wherever you want to go, and please share with the listeners what you've learned and why this is so important, because this whole anti-Semitism thing, of course, this is one of the things that people talk about the Holocaust hoax, and immediately they're branded as anti-Semites.
Well, you know, I was reading an article this morning. In fact, it was about this gentleman who just recently released his name is Gunter Grass, and he recently wrote a poem, and it's called What Must Be Said. And in reading an article about his poem, one of the first things that this article said was the truth is never anti-Semitic, and that is true. And, yep. You know, when you think about it, and also truth does not fear investigation. And so if it's true, if something is true, or on the other hand, if you're trying to conceal something, you are going to try to prevent people from looking into a particular event or investigating it. And you want to silence anybody who has by putting them in jail or, you know, defaming them with names or titles such as anti-Semitic. And but I think there are so many revisionists now that doesn't work as well anymore, and which is a good thing. Now, my interest in the Holocaust began when I was young. I was probably 14 or 16, and right around there. And I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. And it was a very, very big book, almost 1,000 pages. And I read most of it. And I didn't realize at the time that there were such things as court historians or establishment historians. I just figured that if it was in a book, that it was true. And so after reading that book, I followed up by reading a book that was entitled Auschwitz, A Doctor's Eyewitness Account. And it was by Dr. Miklos Nizeli, N-Y-I-S-Z-L-I. And, oh my goodness, I can still remember. You know, I haven't...
Okay, let me just interrupt you, Deanna. Unfortunately, there's the first break. This is really important, so if you can hold that thought. And, of course, that word history, right there, you know, whose story is it? It's his story, that documented report or whatever. Okay, we'll be right back after these messages, folks. Stay tuned. And we're back with What's Ailing America, where our answer today is the Holocaust host, Hoax, with my special guest, Deanna Spingola of Spingola Speaks on Republic Broadcasting, one of the most knowledgeable people on this subject. Please take it away, Deanna, from where you left off before the break.
All right. I had mentioned The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and also this gentleman wrote The Nightmare Years, which I also have, and his name was William L. Shearer, S-H-I-R-E-R. And he was what is called a court historian. In other words, it's somebody who provides the official version of an event. And even during World War II, which these books cover, they had what is called an embedded journalist. In other words, somebody that would be approved by the military, approved by the U.S. government to write the official version. And then the book would come out, and nobody would think to go beyond and write something that was different. And so this was, you know, so I read it and I believed it. And then I followed up with the book by Dr. Miklos Nizeli, which is entitled Auschwitz, A Doctor's Eyewitness Account. And as I was mentioning before the break, I still remember some of the dreadful, dreadful things that he wrote in this book. The only problem is that it's a very deceptive book because, you know, from the title you would think that this was his eyewitness account, but actually it was a novel. The man had never actually been to Auschwitz. It was written as a novel, but the way that it was portrayed made it seem like it was accurate, it was true, and interestingly enough, it came out just about the same time that they were having the trial, and the name of the guy just slipped my mind, Eichmann, the Eichmann trial in Israel, and this was about, when this book came out was in 1961, which was at the time that they were having the Eichmann trial. And when the second edition came out, not with a picture of Auschwitz on the front or a picture of the doctor on the front, it came out with a picture of Eichmann, Adolf Eichmann. And so it was to promote support for Israel. And interestingly enough, there were two things that happened right about the same time, was that all of a sudden, you had a lot of people in the 60s, mid-60s, talking about the Holocaust. And you had movies, Sophie's Choice, and several, The Odessa File, I think that came out about the same time. The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich came out in about 1961, I believe. And and all these things going on at the same time. And then you had, in Germany, despite the terrible, horrific bombing that totally destroyed the country, and most of the cities that have had over 50,000 residents, you had this reawakening in Germany. They were rebuilding their country. They're very industrious, very smart, very, very ethical people. They were rebuilding their country. And so you had these two things going on at about the same time, which is interesting, because all of a sudden you had all of these people that were saying that they were Holocaust survivors, and they were looking for money. They were looking for reparations payments. Now, Germany had huge reparations payments after World War I, and in fact, they were forgiven in the 30s, and then they were reinstated after World War II. In other words, they had all these reparations payments from World War I and World War II, because the Nuremberg military tribunal, actually assigned the entire guilt for the war to Germany, and they had done the same thing for World War I. And so you had all of this money that was going out in reparations payments, and then you had probably as many as 3 million at last count so-called survivors going to Germany or applying for German reparations payments. And then, all of a sudden, you also had a lot of movies coming out of Hollywood. You also had, during the 70s, you had projects like the Shoah Foundation, where they were gathering up all of these testimonies. And testimonies are probably the least reliable thing that you could possibly have. Because if you look at the actual testimonies, the most important one was the one that came out of the Nuremberg tribunal, and that was from the commandant of Auschwitz camp. And he was tortured for about 3 days. They threatened to destroy his family. And when I'm talking about torture, I'm not just saying, we're talking brutal, brutal torture. I'm talking about him being on the floor and having heavy boots stomping on his genitals. I'm talking horrific torture with a whip, and then they got him drunk, and he signed the confession. And the confession said that they had killed in gas chambers 4 million Jews in Auschwitz. And wow. And so that is really the only witness, the only witness that we have. Plus, you have other people who said, "Oh yes, I was there, and I saw the gas chambers." Well, a gentleman, let's see, what was his name? Rasseneyer. It's in one of these books here. It's in the book called Auschwitz, The Final Count. And this is by a gentleman by the name of Vivian Bird. And it was published by the Barnes Review. And he talks about this one individual. Let's see, Paul Rasseneyer, I believe it is his name, Rasseneyer, who was actually at Auschwitz. And he said, I never saw anything like that. And so every time he heard somebody say that they had been at Auschwitz, and he just went and he talked to them. He conducted probably 1,000 interviews. And as soon as he started interviewing somebody, he would discover that the person had not actually seen a gas chamber or had been, saw anything, but that they heard it from their friend. And so when you get right down to it, all the testimony is based on maybe a couple dozen books or eyewitness testimonies. And then, of course, you have the testimonies that Spielberg is producing. And if you listen to any of those, you discover that, gosh, they're just really fluff and so unbelievable that they're unbelievable.
And you're talking about Schindler's List, right? The movie that, wasn't that his movie?
No, that was one of the movies that he produced. He also produced a documentary called Shoah, which gathers all of these testimonies, at least 50,000 testimonies from people who actually had been in a camp. Now, a friend of mine and I went and listened to a so-called Holocaust survivor last summer at the local library, and there was about 150 people there, and this lady told the regular story about how Auschwitz had gas chambers and crematoria and that they were killing all of these people and that she was there. But she never said that she had actually seen a gas chamber. She just went through the formal story. You know, it's the official version of the story. And when you listen to these people, they tell you the official story, the official version, but then they don't relate it to themselves. In other words, she had never seen a gas chamber. She was alive. She worked in the camp for a long time. She was transferred to another camp. And if she's alive, and if all of these 50,000 people are alive to tell their story, and if there are 3 million people who are asking and applying for reparations from the German government, you have to wonder, well, if the NSDAP, if the German government actually had an official policy of extermination, why are all of these people still alive? Why aren't they dead? And I had a guest on my program this past week who wrote a book. It just came out, I believe, in February. It's called The Holocaust Hoax Exposed, Debunking the 20th Century's Greatest Fabrication. It's by Victor Thorne. And so basically what he asks in this book is, and it's an excellent book, it's very reasonably priced, and it's available at his website. And he said, you know, we've all believed that for over 60 years that all of these people were gassed, and the figure started out at 6 million, and it actually started out at 6 million before World War One. World War One, not World War Two, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But okay. if there were an actual policy, why put all these people onto trains, why tattoo them, why provide medical care, why provide barracks, why provide actually something called scrip? In other words, when they worked in the camps, they got paid, and they could use this money at any of the various things that they had. I mean, they even had a brothel at Auschwitz. Mm-mm. Why do all of that? If they were going to kill them, just shoot them in the head.
On the street. Exactly.
Exactly.
Good question. Right. Okay.
Why use all of this energy when there was a war going on? They were fighting on the Western Front. They were fighting on the Eastern Front. They were fighting the United States after 1917. They were fighting the United States. They were fighting France. They were fighting Britain on the Western Front. And they were fighting Russia on the Eastern Front. Now, why in heaven's name would they take all of the people that would be necessary to implement an extermination program? Why take all of these resources and do that when they needed? They needed armaments. They needed bullets. They needed gasoline, which they produced from coal. Why not just put all these people to work? Which is basically what they did. That is basically what they did. And yes, they did buy a lot of Cyclone B. And it happens that during the war, and particularly from the POWs from the East, the Soviets, had a lot of typhus and a lot of lice. And in any war, whether you're talking about the U.S. Civil War, whether you're talking about any war, World War One, the biggest problem in any war is not getting shot by the enemy. The biggest problem is the sanitation, because you're not in some hotel somewhere. You're out in a field. It's muddy. You're going to get lice. You're going to get sick. And you're going to get the flu. You're going to get all kinds of sicknesses. And the worst killer during World War II was typhus. And that is carried by lice. And so what they did with Cyclone B is that they created little chambers. And these chambers weren't big. I mean, they might hold 25 people. But what they actually did hold was clothes. And so as soon as they got some people in from the train, they would have them take off their clothes. They would go into a shower. They would use special medicinal soap to get rid of the lice. They would shave their head. And this protected them from disease. They didn't want a bunch of dead people. They wanted people who could work in the war industry. And so that is what they did.
So the gas was used primarily to gas their clothes, to get rid of the lice on their clothes. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And the U.S. Army used DDT. The Germans used Cyclone B. And this gas leaves a residue in the walls. It, you know, in a place where they have used this gas, the walls are going to be blue. And those chambers in which they used the Cyclone B to fumigate the clothes, you see this blue. Now, in the chamber that the tour guide at Auschwitz claims is the gas chamber was actually a bomb shelter. And after the war, the Russians are the ones that liberated Auschwitz. And when they came in, they kind of recreated that big chamber. They took out some of the partition walls, and they built a chimney. So to give the impression that there was, there was something there that wasn't. They did have a crematoria in which they cremated people who had passed away from typhus or from other illnesses. And so they redid this bomb shelter. And an individual, in fact, several individuals, but this one individual, Fred Leuchter, was the foremost expert on gas chambers in this country. And Ernst Zundel, during the famous 1988 trial up in Canada, Ernst Zundel hired Fred Leuchter to go to Poland, to go to Auschwitz, and to look at the gas chamber, the supposed gas chamber, because he was an expert. In fact, he was probably created, designed, and he was an engineer. That's his job. He was a gas chamber engineer, the foremost expert in the United States. So he went over to Auschwitz, and he produced a report, the Leuchter report, and he said the alleged gas chambers at the inspected sites could not have then been or now be utilized or seriously considered to function as execution gas chambers, unquote. Now, these gas chambers, well, the one at Auschwitz, had a door that opened inward, and it was a glass panel door. There was some shower heads that supposedly, the gas came out of the shower heads, and there was a crease under the door, and air. It wasn't airtight. If you look at a gas chamber here in this country, it's airtight. The door has a big thing that you have to turn to make sure that it's totally airtight. There are seals all around the door. I mean, it's very, very airtight. And what they were saying
Let me just say, because that's how they euthanize many pets, in these kill shelters. So we do have gas chambers, in fact, in the United States. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And we have them at many of the prisons because this country executes probably more people than China. I'm not sure that, you know, but we do have the highest rate of incarcerated people in this country than any other country in the world, which is very interesting. But anyway, Mr. Leuchter said there is absolutely no way that they could have executed anybody. And yet at the Nuremberg trials, the people who testified said, oh, yes, they would put, you know, a couple hundred people in there and drop these pallets in, and they would be dead in, you know, maybe 20 minutes. Well, that is just not true at all. And then they said, and then after that, all the guards would go in and pull these bodies out. Well, you know, the pallets take longer to work. And guards, when he said the guards would just go in and start pulling these people out, that's just not likely because it would affect the guards also because it wouldn't even start to work until a couple hours. And this person is, you know, the person that gave testimony at the Nuremberg tribunal was just kind of making it up as he went along. And also these people, the people at Nuremberg and the witnesses were tortured, and many of the people that participated as interrogators, as translators, were new citizens of America, most of whom came from Eastern Europe, and most of whom were Jewish. And so the Nuremberg War Trial was basically a show trial, and the people who did the most egregious things, who committed the most trials, were not being tried. Rather, the losers of the war, the people who lost the war, were in the dockets. Where, you know, here you had Russia, the Soviets, who were acting as judge and jury, who had killed millions upon millions of people, and were certainly more guilty than anybody they had in the docket. And it was just amazing. And of course, we know that the winner writes the history. We also know that the winner is the one that gets to try the loser. And it was a terrible injustice, but it also was a precedent for setting up a world tribunal. And that was one of the goals of the world or the Jewish committee back as early as 1917, when they decided that after World War I, what they wanted to do was to set up a tribunal so that they could punish those who had persecuted the Jews. And they were mainly talking about the people, at that time it was Russia before the Jews took over Russia, before the Bolshevik Revolution, and before the before that all occurred. But they wanted to punish anybody who had persecuted the Jews, and so they wanted a tribunal. Well, they were not successful in getting a tribunal after World War I, but they were successful after World War II.
And if I could just chime in here, this idea of persecuting the Jews, all you have to do is look at some of the tidbits from the Talmud and different things that says, how they're allowed to lie, cheat, steal. We have their Kol Nidre they take on their Day of Atonement. Basically, there was good reason why the Jews were being, quote-unquote, persecuted and being, you know, chased out of one country after another because of the crimes they were committing.
Oh, absolutely. They have been actually chased out of or deported from 108 countries from 200 AD on. And certainly they would not have been regarded as such if they were trying to live according to the host country's policies. But in fact, that is not what they've ever done. They always become a nation within a nation, and or a state within a state.
a predator state, I would say. Okay, sure. There's the music. We're going to a break. I have a couple quick questions I want to ask you after the break of things I've always wanted to know, because you're such an expert on this. Okay, folks, hold on. We'll be right back after these messages. And we're back with What's Ailing America, where our answer today is the Holocaust host, Hoax, with my special guest, Deanna Spingola of Spingola Speaks on Republic Broadcasting. And I just have to say, I have CNN on in the background just reading, actually the Zionist News Network, just reading the little flags they have at the bottom of the screen. They're showing the NSA spy center in the Utah mountains, and it's just chilling what's going on. But anyways, there's a couple questions I wanted to ask you, Deanna. First of all, in regards to the tattoos, you know, that's something they always show. What's his name? Ellie Weiss, one of the biggest mouthpieces for this hoax that's out there and about. You know, they're always showing their tattoos. So the tattoos were real, but apparently that was just a way that they numbered people to work in the camps. Was that the situation?
Yes. You know, that we all have, you know, people who work usually have a card or something that gets them, you know, that shows that they work at a particular place, like nurses or you know, they have a name card or something. And the way that they kept track of people was to give them a tattoo. And that tattoo was associated with their record. And they kept impeccable records. And in fact, in 1991, after these records became available, Auschwitz, the death figure for Auschwitz was 73,137. And of that figure, 73,137, 38,031 were Jews. So that's it. 38,000. Now that's a lot of people. But when you consider the enormous complex, this was not just one camp. It was a huge, huge facility. And when you consider the Allied bombing, and most of the people died in the last couple of months of the war, and it was because of the Allied bombing. It was because of the Allies had destroyed the transportation system so that the camp was not receiving any food, and so you had starvation, you had typhus, because they weren't receiving their Cyclone B, so you had a lot of typhus, you had a lot of starvation, and so when and this was true for Buchenwald and some of the other camps. And so when the Allies liberated these camps, they found people that looked like emaciated skeletons, and they took pictures and made certain that all the countries had representatives there. In fact, they had a director. Let's see, I'm trying to think of his name. He used to direct Marilyn Monroe in some of her feature films. One of the directors from Hollywood was there to take pictures. And in fact, Eisenhower, General Eisenhower, as soon as he liberated Buchenwald, got a hold of the U.S. Congress. Certain members of Congress come over. They had the top journalists come over. And the reason that they did that, or the reason that he did that, is because he wanted to shine all of this light on what had happened in the German camps so that he could conceal the more than 200 camps that he had established in Germany, in which he put all Germans, men, women, children. And these camps were not actually camps. They were simply barbed wire enclosures with a tower. There was no latrine. There was no hospital. There was no brothel. There was no kitchen. There was nothing. Now, in Auschwitz, you had a hospital. You had a library. You had a theater. They had a band. They had a soccer field. They had a swimming pool. They had a post office where people could actually work and live, because remember, these people were workers. They wanted to keep the workers happy. They wanted to keep them content. They wanted to keep them healthy. They had not only a hospital, but an infirmary, you know, where they could dispense, you know, whatever a sick person might need. And so all of this attention that Eisenhower wanted to focus on on the Germans was basically to cover up his own war crimes.
Wow. What a surprise, Nat. Okay. One of the things we always hear about is the horrific experimentation that was going on there, and especially, you know, Mengele's name comes up. What's the real deal on Mengele?
All righty. He was a doctor, but we usually hear, and the first thing that I heard about him or read about him was that he was the guy that stood when the train doors were open, when the trains came in, that he would point to the left or to the right, and those people who went to the right were killed, and those people who went to the left worked, or, you know, they got to live. And there was no experimentation that was, well, he did do some experimentation, but not the kind that we have been told about. He was interested in twins, but he didn't do these bizarre things that he has been accused of. In fact, we covered it on a recent program, but there just isn't that much there. And, of course, some of this stuff came from that one book that I mentioned by Dr. Nye Isley. And in his book, and I think that's where a lot of it came from, and, of course, some of it also came from The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. In Nye Isley's book, he said that they actually had a great big pot out on the lawn. There was a lawn there, and that they had boiled a couple of skeletons because they wanted to get the meat real, or they wanted to get the skeletons, and so they boiled them to quickly get rid of the meat. And he related that some of the prisoners were eating the meat, and that was one thing I remembered, and that was, you know, as a child, as a young woman, I thought, oh my gosh, this is so gross. And, you know, of course, these things are meant, like the Diary of Anne Frank, which also influenced me emotionally until I discovered that it was not authentic. I mean, it was written in a ballpoint pen with a couple of different styles of handwriting. But these books that we read and that students are required to read now in the government schools impact us emotionally. They're not scientific. They're just meant to impact us emotionally, and that is what all of these testimonies are designed to do, is to impact us emotionally. And when my friend and I went to the library and heard this woman, Magda Brown, who's associated with the local Holocaust Museum, I mean, it was an emotional presentation. It was all emotion. She was very charismatic. She was, you know, she laughed and she was, you know, very charismatic. But she didn't give any real evidence. Now, not a single solitary autopsy was performed on anyone that indicated that they died from poison gas. No autopsy was ever performed. There were doctors that went in and did autopsies on some of the dead bodies. Not one of them died from poison gas. All of the autopsies that were ever done showed that they died from disease or starvation.
Did you get a chance to ask this woman any hard questions when you went to hear her in the library?
There was one gentleman that asked a question. The very minute the question came out of his mouth, the rest of the audience started booing or you know, saying, oh, we came here to hear her. And, you know, I mean, it was just a total demonstration of how people censor others who want to ask the truth. And this happens in any kind of a situation, whether we're talking a student, an inquisitive student in a classroom who raises his hand and objects or questions what the teacher is saying, the rest of the class with this herd mentality will say, oh, don't ask, or, you know, something like that. We self-censor each other.
Well,
or self-censor ourselves.
You can be sure that the place was basically, put different molds in there just to do that very thing in case anybody should ask a hard question, and that's how they get the rest of the crowd revved up, you know, for the people that are there for that very purpose to do that, yes.
Sure.
Okay, go ahead.
And it was very interesting. I had given some presentations at the library, at least I attempted to. My friend and I attempted to. We thought, oh, let's show some 9/11 films. Well, you know, we hardly had anybody arrive to see the film. Whereas this presentation, they brought in food, they brought in bottled water, they advertised it for you know, a month in advance. They put it in the library newsletter. I mean, this is government sanctioned, okay? Because the taxpayer pays the library, okay? It's taxpayer funded. It is a government institution, and they provide the books that are politically correct. I tried to get a book into the local library here. Democracy After, or Afghanistan After Democracy by Dr. Mohammed Meraki. And they said, oh, no, it's too graphic. We can't, you know, we can't have that book.
Yeah, and that's an excellent book. Actually, one of our joint listeners sent me that book. Shocking, shocking photographs of what's actually happening, especially to the children born with these horrific anomalies. I mean, yeah, and that's called graphic. Like you said,
right.
The truth is ugly. We can't deal with it. Okay,
right.
There's music. We're going to a break. We have to go through the you know, news on this one. If you want to get a drink of water or something, this will be about 5 minutes. Okay, folks, hold on. We'll be back after these messages.
At OrionTalkRadio.com, you could say that we're all talk.
Dr. Banks is the only medical doctor I have found in 15 years.